Hello and welcome back to the Millennial Ag Podcast, where agriculture is always on tap and no topic is off limits. Thanks for joining us today, your co-hosts, Valene Cawhorn and Catherine Lotsbeach. At Peacock Technology, we're transforming dairy farming with robotics and AI. Our pre-brush and post-spray robots work on rotary milking parlors to ensure consistent udder hygiene, alleviating labor shortages, and maintaining high standards year-round. Our advanced vision system and online platform integrates data from wearables and body condition scores, giving farmers a complete view of each cow's health and performance, saving time and cost while boosting efficiency and profitability. Peacock Technology, empowering better decisions for your herd's well-being and productivity. Visit peacocktechnology.com to learn more. Listeners, welcome to the last week in May. We're coming off the heels of our May Mental Health series and cannot forget to celebrate May National Beef Month. And so we are really excited to have a fun episode here with Dr. Phil Bass. He was on, it's been a good number of years ago, to talk about carcasses and one of my favorite meat scientists and most dynamic professors I've heard from, Dr. Bass is back. And he's at the University of Idaho, but he's also had some education at Colorado State University. So I always have to plug my Rams when I can too. So thanks, Dr. Bass, for joining us this week.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Maybe to get started, do you want to just give a brief background about yourself and what you do for the University of Idaho?
Yeah. So grew up in rural Northern California and dairy beef cattle country. Undergrad and master's at Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo, California.
Woo! Go Mustangs! Yeah.
So I went from a green and gold school to another green and gold school, Colorado State University, for my PhD. And then spent 8 glorious years out in Ohio with Certified Angus Beef, being their meat scientist. But it was time to move back west. Now we're within driving distance of my hometown, which is really cool. We're here in North Idaho and loving every minute of it. I'm grateful to be here, and it's a great school to work for.
Awesome. Well, I think they're really blessed to have you too, providing top-end research for the beef industry. Maybe to get us started, we've noticed and we've tracked for quite some time the number of cattle on feed and total inventory is down. But I noticed in a presentation last year that even though cow numbers are down, beef production isn't trending the same line, and that's primarily because of carcass weight. So what, maybe walk us through what's going on in that realm of the industry.
Yeah, you know, serendipitously during my PhD work at Colorado State, I did research on heavyweight carcasses. And if I want to use air quotes of heavyweight, I'll give you guys a little background. That 20 years ago when I was doing that research, a really heavy beef carcass was 850 pounds. That was a really, really heavy one. And I was excited to find one like that. And we were doing profile and we were cutting them down to the individual muscles, weighing the muscles, et cetera, trying to just better understand them. Now, 850 pounds is about 100 pounds under what the average steer carcass weight weighs. Average. So the last few weeks, we've been somewhere on average for steer carcasses between 930 and 950 pounds. It's not unusual to find carcasses that are over 1,000 pounds. I was just recently in a packing house and it was 1,000, 1,000, 1,000, 1,000. You know, it just, it's unbelievable the size of these critters. Now, thankfully, we do have big cattle. And like you've already said, Val, the number of cattle that we have available to us right now is definitely on a decline. I don't see that recovering for a while now. We need to see some rain in the Central Plains so that the folks out there can start rebuilding herds. And that's probably a few years off yet. And so thankfully, we have set ourselves up for somewhat of a success in the beef industry by choosing animals with greater growth potential. And then also, we've been hitting a pretty good stride with the cost of feed and doing business, even though it's still a bit of a thin margin area. Most folks who own cattle are making money right now. And a lot of that has to do with the extra size that we're getting on them. And so, yeah, you're right. You know, we maybe don't have quite as much beef being produced, but it would have been a lot less if we didn't have these really big carcasses. And there's a ton of interest and demand for beef out there right now. And so we're able to fulfill a lot of that right now with these bigger animals.
That it sounds, you know, that situation is kind of the same across the board in American agriculture, right? We've been getting better and better at producing more product with fewer resources. You know, we're producing a lot more milk with far fewer cows than we have in the past. So same thing in the beef industry. It sounds like another similarity between beef and dairy is, it sounds like the populations aren't bouncing back as fast as we would like them to be in the beef industry based on drought and other factors. And in the cattle industry or in the dairy industry, I would venture a guess at breeding so incredibly heavy to beef on dairy so that we could capitalize on that as well. And now because of avian flu and other factors, we're having to pull those heifers or those animals and those matings back into the dairy industry. Is that having the kind of effect that I think it's having on the beef industry, the dairy guys having to go away from beef on dairy?
So first off, I really hope that that doesn't happen in a large scale, because I've been praising a lot of the dairy producers that I interact with, that the dairy industry is right now somewhat of a savior of the U.S. beef industry because of those beef on dairy cattle that we've been getting. So we've been able to backfill a lot of what otherwise would have been empty hooks in packing houses. So either way, I'm sure we'll continue to get male calves in the dairy industry, even though we're using more and more sex semen and things like that. But I would really encourage our dairy producers out there to continue to breed beef on dairy. Those beef on dairy calves are very valuable, not just from a standpoint of filling hooks in a packing house, but also do the math. The dollar value is there. Those calves are worth hundreds, if not close to $1,000 a piece, just because we need the beef, and they make excellent, excellent beef. Milking production is highly correlated to marbling, and marbling is what we focus on in the beef industry for providing premiums to cattle producers, and it's just easier to sell. And so in short, I really hope that we don't back off too far from the beef on dairy. If we do, still get us those dairy calves, because we'll turn them into beef. So
you know, it's been a really good resource and, you know, sort of diversification for the dairy industry. So it's encouraging to hear that from someone in the beef industry. And I had no idea that milk production was correlated with marbling. That's a fascinating fact for a Tuesday.
How about that?
So maybe to go into some of the work you're doing, you know, we've got these larger carcasses, but we've got fewer carcasses. So what are you guys seeing as far as value added products coming out of those carcasses to meet the demand that's really high for beef right now?
So in short, we're really starting to embrace single muscle fabrication. And I would say that the U.S. beef industry has been doing this somewhat more or less for the last 20, 25 years. The great example is the flat iron steak. At one time, it used to be part of a giant roast, and we would sell it for $1.29 at the local IGA and call it good. Now, this thing is considered almost a middle meat. You know, we're in the $9 to $12 a pound wholesale sometimes with a flat iron steak. And that's a muscle that comes out of the shoulder, out of the chuck. By continuing to focus on these individual muscles, not only do we decrease variation between bites when we're grilling these things or cooking them off, single muscles now are going to give us more consistency and overall acceptability. But then also, because these animals are so much larger, we're able to make an entire steak or an entire roast out of a single muscle. This is not a new concept for the world. This is very much a European style of meat cutting and fabrication. We're just more embracing it here in the United States because the value is really there. Now, beyond just the fabrication side, we're having to look at the carcasses a little bit different from just a chilling side of things. And so, you know, we're a beef animal. It's 101.5 degrees Fahrenheit internal temp. We're slaughtering it, but now we have to take that mass of muscle down to under 40 degrees in about 24 hours. So that's quite the task, considering we've added so much more weight to these carcasses over time. So here at the University of Idaho, we've looked at alternative fabrication on the slaughter floor to expose more of the muscle surface area to try to dump more of that heat from big muscles like the round. We're starting to see them. Some companies embrace this idea of opening up more seams in the round, in the chuck, to allow for more of that heat dissipation in the coolers. We're also seeing a number of companies really embrace the idea of removing abdominal fat from the carcass prior to going into the chilling process. It makes a lot of sense, since that abdominal fat, first off, is an insulator. So it's going to slow down the chilling process of everything that it's underneath, say like tenderloins and ribs and flank and all that kind of stuff. But then also, you know, on average, you're pulling about 20 pounds of abdominal fat off of these carcasses. And why would we chill that down and use all that energy when we're just going to heat it back up for rendering? And so if we start with something that's already pretty warm and send it right on to rendering, we're gonna manage the heat exchange a lot better, save on energy. That's a huge dollar savings for these plants. We're not chilling fat just to warm it back up. We're just starting off with warm fat and then rendering it down. So it's way beyond just kind of looking at the carcass a little bit different. It's looking at the entirety of the process to make sure that the system still is profitable at the packing house. Because at the moment right now, May of 2025, packing houses are really struggling to make any money because of the cost of doing business and the shortage of cattle.
The heat exchange and the energy exchange there is a really fascinating point to me because, you know, again, across agriculture, we're always looking for efficiencies to be gained, especially in energy costs. I mean, that is rampant across agriculture, but especially animal ag. And again, coming back to dairy, because that's what I know and love. Again, milk comes out of a cow at 101.5 degrees, and then that actually has to be chilled down to 50 degrees within 2 hours, and then lower than that within whatever it is. But, you know, we try to capture that heat as well through a plate cooler and then use that energy to then heat water to wash down the barn or whatever it is. Are there opportunities here to do that same kind of thing? Or is it, I mean, it's an entirely different beast. You know, I have no idea how you would capture energy, just heat energy coming off of a carcass while you're harvesting it. But is that something that can be done?
I think that there's probably mechanical engineers, chemical engineers, people who understand thermal dynamics that could probably be capturing an awful lot of energy just by the heat that's generated on the slaughter floor itself,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But that's beyond my realm of expertise by far. But I would tell you, you know, just the idea of pulling some of that fat, more of that fat off on the slaughter floor.
Yeah.
You're saving the energy that otherwise would have been used for chilling it and then reheating it from a chilled state. So there's a huge energy savings in a passive manner in that case.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm very familiar with, like, you know, you go to a creameries and they're absolutely trying to capture a lot of that heat once they raise milk up to the 161 for our pasteurization. Then we got to chill it back down. And so we're using plate exchangers to recapture all of that heat to maintain efficiencies in temperature. So more in a passive way, I would say, at the packing house. However, we have to also think about what I would consider static energy that's trapped in that fat itself. These packing houses, these big packing houses especially, that have the means, are finding ways of rendering down the fats. There's an enormous amount of energy in that fat that can now be converted into other types of fuels. Biodiesel. Guys, we're making jet fuel out of beef fat right now. If you can believe that. Is that America or what? Huh? Like, so jet fuel, biodiesel. I mean, there's so much great energy that's trapped inside that fat that we can do so many things. Now, beyond that too, think about the immense amount of water that's being treated and going into lagoons and things. We're already seeing this in the dairy industry, capturing the methane, capturing the natural gas. That's what methane is. It's natural gas. Capturing that from that aerobic and anaerobic digestion of the treated water systems and using that to fire boilers back in the packing house. So there's a lot of engineering and physics going on in these packing houses. It's not just killing beef and hanging them on a hook. It is very much thinking about the entirety of the process and how can we make this thing as efficient as possible so that we can keep prices of the meat itself down and still be making a profit, and we can pay our farmers in the end for the great animals they're producing.
I love that because it's a full life cycle, right? Of energy, of animals, of workers too, and so forth. And so thinking about it in a holistic approach is the only way to do it, because we can't continue to do things the way we did when the packing plants first opened in the early 1900s, or we wouldn't have enough beef to continue to feed the world or make a profit. So I love that. As you're diving into all these nuances and figuring out, you know, how to save energy and be more efficient, pull off different stakes, cut them differently. For the new plants, they've designed them to accomplish this, but the older packing plants, you know, the JBSs, Tysons that have been here for a good number of years, how are they adapting with these new changes?
Yeah. So they're absolutely retrofitting right now, and they have to continue to improve efficiencies and chilling processes, bringing in different condensers, different evaporators, different things that are going to help with that heat exchange in the hot boxes or the refrigeration systems that we're using. Now, there's actually some really cool, oh, I would call it older technology, but we use what's called spray chilling in the beef industry. Beef and lamb carcasses will put a fine mist or a gentle shower in the initial cooling process for about 16 hours. And what that does is keeps the surface of that carcass wet. Well, think about if you walk out on a really cold day with wet hair, like you get really, really cold. That's because it's a great heat exchange, right? That's what we're doing to the carcasses, is that water helps to exchange that heat that much more. And so we're able to chill those carcasses a lot better as a result. That's not necessarily new technology, but maybe for folks that are out there listening, it might be new to them.
So we're talking about all the really cool technologies that are, you know, coming alongside to take advantage of efficiencies and, you know, capitalize on a smaller beef population to be able to continue to produce what America wants. I'm wondering, you know, we talk about this in the dairy industry again. Sorry to keep coming back to that. That's
all right.
Correlation that I have.
Milk is an excellent byproduct of the beef industry.
So. I'm going to put that on a t-shirt, wear it to dairy meetings and see what happens.
When they make their final career change, they all become beef, right? So
we talk about in the dairy industry, how far can we push dairy cows, you know, ethically and biologically? How far can we push them in milk production? And I mean, we're coming to the conclusion that we feed them right and we treat them right. I mean, there's almost no ceiling on those girls. What about for a beef carcass? Are we nearing a biological limit? Is there still room to grow? Does that make sense for the industry economically, all the way across?
That's an excellent question. And I think that's something that's been top of mind for almost the last 10 years, is that how big can we make these things? I remember having conversations in my previous occupation 15, almost 20 years ago, where we were thinking these carcasses are getting bigger and bigger, and we're adding on average in a linear fashion, 5 pounds of carcass weight per year, per year, since the 1970s. And it's a perfect line. Like, it's incredible considering its biological data, how consistent this line is. And I've been saying that for almost 20 years now, guys. So not a lot has changed. We're just getting really good at growing big animals. And
also very American. How American is that?
Very American. Very American. You know, you think about it, it's efficiency. And that's what we like to do. We like to maximize. And here's the problem with maximizing, is that the chicken business maximized back in the late 90s, early 2000s. And they were having very large death rates at a lot of these chicken farms because they grew them too big, too fast. And so they're having to find a nice balance of an efficient bird that grows well, but also has a physiology that can handle it. And so, like you're saying about the dairy cows, we don't know what the top end is for production-wise on these, but eventually we're going to have to go back and look at skeletal structure, musculature. Can they continue to function well, even with this really, really high capacity of growth?
Yeah.
Well, that's where we're at, I think, right now, intensively thinking about in the beef industry, because we're essentially making a fat kid out in these feed yards. Right? I mean, we're taking this calf that has immense growth potential. You know, when I was growing up, we used to say it was 7 pounds of feed to a pound of gain for our steers, for our 4-H steers. Now that's closer to 5 pounds of feed to a pound of gain. That's an incredible efficiency that has been grown there. And so we're taking these animals with immense growth potential, but then also putting fat on them. Well, we know from a human perspective that an obese person will have a harder time on their cardiopulmonary system. And that's something that we need to be observant about in the cattle industry. And so recently I was part of a research project here at the University of Idaho, where one of our faculty members actually has a background in human cardiac physiology that we're now applying to the beef industry. And so Tara Gertzen, who just finished her master's degree here, she was going to feed yards around, getting hearts from necropsied animals, as well as going to packing houses from what we would consider perfectly healthy animals, and taking physical measurements of heart valve dimensions and ventricular wall thicknesses, and scoring this stuff, not just from a subjective measure, which for the last 5-10 years, most of the beef industry has really embraced, but more from an objective measure and trying to see, are there some patterns out there to animals that we're quote unquote maximizing the potential of these critters? Is there a problem with the cardiopulmonary system that we need to be aware of? And we know that that was a big problem in the poultry industry, that the hearts couldn't keep up with the growth that these birds were achieving. We want to make sure we nip this in the bud on the cattle side. And it's definitely something that cattle feeders are aware of, that we do have congestive heart failure in some of these steers that are out in the yards. And we don't know if it was just something that's always been underlying, and now we're starting to hit a growth potential that it's starting to manifest itself, or have genetics changed enough over time to maybe have some animals predisposed to this condition. I mean, these are 18-month steers that are having congestive heart failure. So that's not a good thing. From an economic-wise, that's not a good thing. It's not a good thing for the animal either. So I think it's time that we do kind of focus in on that area. Also, in short, to address the size question, is that calf, that 18-month-old calf that's 1,500 pounds finished, 1,500 to 1,600 pounds finished weight, how big is its mama? And how big can we allow her to get before she becomes inefficient and we can't keep her around because she's got to be fed year-round? So there's a lot going on there. And I think the next time we have tight feed prices, it might start to have an impact on how big those mama cows are, and which will lead to how big these calves will possibly be later on.
So this is a whole conversation in EPDs, feed efficiency, and a whole thing. You could end up on another rabbit trail completely.
I am not a geneticist by any means. Please don't go down that road. But just my observations anyway.
But it's an interesting thought, you know, focusing in on the cows too that have to raise those calves, because, you know, we're short on cow numbers right now, a lot due to drought. And so we have less rangeland feed, we have less feed for those mama cows in the country. And so we continue to push them and push the calves. Are we going to continue to reduce, you know, the number of cows we have as well, instead of start rebuilding the herd? Like, we're not seeing those trends correct itself yet.
Yeah, I don't know where that's going to be. I'm hoping and praying and doing the rain dance for the Central Plains as much as I can, because that's the only way we're going to rebuild this herd, is if they can get some reprieve. They've been dry for the last couple of years. I think it's coming. As the old farmer says, we're just a day closer to rain.
Yeah,
we just don't know how many days that is.
Yeah, right.
You know? But you're right. We have to feed these critters, and we have to manage the feed. And part of those dynamics too is fuel costs. Because we've got to run tractors to go harvest feed in many cases. And so, yeah, definitely we will utilize the rangeland, especially out here in the West, especially in Idaho, where we are. Rangeland and range grazing is extremely important. But we also have a lot of places that rely on feed delivery, especially in the finishing phase. And so that's going to be a dynamic that we'll have to continue to keep an eye on too, is that if we have a repeat of like 2013-14, where we have $7 and $8 bushel corn, where we're closer to like the fours right now, that's going to put a strain on everything. And that might cause some of these animals to be a little bit smaller too. So
building off of it, but another question is demand for beef right now is huge. Like, we're, even though we're short or down on supply, demand still really, really strong. Do you see that changing at all with beef becoming not scarce, but reduced in volume with our lower numbers?
So, yeah, that's a great question. That's something I keep an eye on quite regularly. There's extreme demand for beef, which is awesome to see, both domestically and internationally. And thankfully, we do have that international demand, because they like to take a lot of the items that we don't put a lot of value here in the United States. So the offals, the hearts, the lungs, the kidneys, the livers. Yeah, I mean, we have some really strong demand around here. I would say I've been saying that we hadn't reached an apex on the cost of beef at a grocery store. People are still buying it. They're just complaining more. I think we may, however, we may be starting to get to that point where it's like, you know what? That pork chop does look pretty good. And when you're buying one strip loin steak at a grocery store that's over $20, one, that's a hit. That's hard for folks to do. There's still a lot of money out there. There's still a lot of countries that really want our beef. It'll be really interesting to see the UK for the first time in my known existence is now open for beef, US beef exports.
Yeah.
However, we've had a lot of curtailment of sales to China. But really, if you think about it, that market has only been open for about 5 years anyway. They've been backfilling with a lot of South American beef. And so that beef that was going to China, it's going to be diverted elsewhere. It's all part of the spider web of the whole beef economy. I didn't see a huge drop in beef prices when we started to engage in trade negotiations with China recently. And so the demand is definitely there. We may even be getting a reprieve domestically in cost at the grocery store as a result of some of the trade negotiations internationally. We do want to still see good trade with other countries, because if we can't sell those livers, hearts, kidneys to other countries, then that's going to drive the cost up of the muscle cuts that we do desire here domestically. So I don't know. Stay tuned. Poultry continues to just be a mammoth of a protein option that continues to grow. However, beef demand, it's very, very strong. I don't see anybody that's really turning it down that much, but I think we're right about in that decision-making point with a lot of folks.
I know for myself, just personally, anecdotally, you know, my husband and I raised a couple steers a couple of years ago, and we're getting towards the end of that particular supply. And obviously we will resupply. I don't know if we're going to raise a couple more, if we're just going to buy it, because it's honestly about sixes at this point. But it makes me start to get a little twitchy, you know, when the ground beef is getting less than 20 pounds in the freezer, and the steaks, Yeah. You know, the steaks are mostly gone because those are the good ones. So,
I mean, my family, we're grateful that we have our own cattle and we raise them, but I still go to the meat counter every time I'm in a grocery store and just kind of see what the prices are. I would say that ground beef pricing is starting to kind of level out. It's still high, but it's starting to level out a little bit. Steaks are the ones that I'm impressed that folks are willing to spend that kind of money still for steaks, and I'm grateful for it. I also attribute a lot of that to the fact that we have really high quality beef out there right now, guys. We're grading as a country, as a whole, about 85% choice and prime. Of the prime choice select breakdown, prime is around 12% of the grade, which is just unheard of. It's absolutely incredible. I have grading cards here that USDA are planning on making updates to, where we're adding more marbling levels to the grading standards just because academically we need it. I wouldn't say that we're going to have like a super prime category come out anytime soon, but there's a lot of work that the Wagyu folks have done, that the Angus associations have pushed forward on marbling genetics, that have started to lead many of the other breeds to demonstrate that marbling is such an important thing. It is quality, and it's a measure of quality at the grocery store, at the restaurant. And both entities are really looking for that high quality product because people want it and are willing to pay for it.
So for the number of animals that are, you know, below choice, are those coming out of the feed yards, or are those cull cows?
No, yeah, that's a good question. They're still young animals coming out of the feed yards. Don't quote me on this, even though it's recorded, I know. I'd have to go back and look, but I asked Randy Block a few years ago, will select, so for those who aren't familiar, Randy Block, president CEO of Cattle Facts, has probably one of the best pulses of the beef market in anywhere. And I asked him a number of years back, will select ever go away? And he kind of scratched his head and said, no, I don't think it will. It'll definitely become a smaller player. And that's what we're seeing right now. You know, in the 90s, select was almost half of the beef being graded in this country. 48% in 1995. was select. And now it's often less than 15% on a weekly basis. So the entirety of the beef industry has changed to higher marble cattle because cattle producers get paid more if their animals are more valuable. So more per pound. The question is, will the select become a thing of the past? And where are they? And the reality is most of them are probably in the Southeast, coming out of feed yards, oftentimes have Bos Indicus genetics, so Brahman type genetics. It doesn't mean you can't have a good steak off of those animals. They're just a different critter. And if you have the traditional Bos Taurus, European type breeds, Angus Hereford, Shorthorn, even the Charolais, Simmental, Limousin, they're a different animal. They have greater propensity towards marbling. But, you know, those Brahma cattle down in the Southeast have a great purpose. They can handle the hot, humid climates that our traditional European breeds have a hard time with. And so we're still generating great quality beef. It's just maybe not to the same extent in the prime and choice categories as you normally would. So I hope I don't get too much hate mail from our Brahma breeders out there. It's a historical fact.
It's a historical fact. There we go. Yeah. So we're talking about, you know, value based on marbling and, you know, or improving genetics in that regard. And, you know, all the things that you just talked about in terms of that kind of value, is there a product diversification or utilization coming into play that, you know, that into the American market that we might not have seen before? I know that, are they calling ancestral meats or ancient meats or something? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I'm going to upset some folks now.
Yes!
I'm
okay with Let's do it.
Yeah, so this ancestral blends, as yes. you would say, with some of these ground beef products is where we're taking maybe heart and kidney and liver and mixing into a ground beef mix, okay? Legally, that can't be called ground beef because ground beef, by legal standards, has to be skeletal muscle tissue and adjacent fat. So this has to be called ancestral blend. It has to be guts and meat. I don't know what you want to call it. If I were to bring in some folks who maybe were butchers in the 1950s through the 1970s, that used to be called cheating because, you know, you're selling something that otherwise in the past was less desirable to the U.S. domestic clientele. And you're mixing it in with something that was more sought after, which was the ground beef itself. Now we have folks who have that interest. And I think that's cool. I mean, so I say that all tongue in cheek and in jest. If people want to have ground beef with liver mixed in, go nuts. I think that's wonderful. The more we use of that animal, the better. And in fact, if we're having growing demand for offal cuts in the United States domestically, it's going to just drive more value to the whole beef carcass because we have huge demand for those items internationally. It's going to lift all of the ships as a result if people truly want that. Personally, it's not something I'm too keen on. I appreciate the offals. I love a good lingua taco, you know, just tongue tacos, beef cheeks. Oh my gosh, braised beef cheeks are incredible. But the reality is we haven't really diversified more with the carcass these days. The entirety of the carcass has been sold for as long as you can think. It's just, how have we diversified in the merchandising and have we been able to isolate better markets for certain cuts? Again, if we can ship livers to the Middle East, they love them. Middle East, Egypt, we send a lot of those items over there and they just appreciate the robustness of the flavor, probably the color that we can generate here with our younger beef, things like that. And then also just south the border into Mexico, they really appreciate those offals. Here domestically, there's been a resurgence of, I would say, the young millennial and Gen Z crowd that are just interested in something different and maybe have never eaten liver before and think it's kind of cool and wants to try something new and something strong and robust. You know, I talk about, I go down the beer aisle at a grocery store and it's nothing but IPA this and that. Yeah. Really strong, bold flavors. I'm like, golly, give me a High Life sometimes. I'm a little, maybe not so much in your face, but that is something that's indicative of what the customers are wanting. They want that strong flavor all the way down to like Doritos. I've seen Sriracha Doritos out there, like super big, bold flavors. And so maybe that's where we're at now with the livers and kidneys. it's a different flavor. It's a different experience, a different way of consuming and enjoying beef. I encourage it. Maybe it's not for me, but I think it's cool that there is that much interest out there for all these other pieces and parts that otherwise lost popularity here domestically.
Well, and I think we have an amazing community of marketers too, because the way they market some of that product is like, once you start reading the fine print of what it actually is, you're like, oh, this is, yeah, just ground up liver and kidneys. But we've got a good marketing team helping drive those products.
Yeah. Well, and there's a lot of great nutrition in there. You know, if you want fat soluble vitamins, liver is excellent for that. You know, especially if you need vitamin A in your diet, liver is an excellent, excellent source for that. Beef in general is a great source of all nutrients. But if you need those extra fortifications, grinding up some liver in there is a great way of doing that. And I know that that's kind of how some of the influencers out there have started to talk about these more ancestral blends, if you want to call them that.
Yeah, I think I said ancient. Probably no one wants ancient beef.
That's just well-aged.
Well-aged, long-aged beef. And you might as well cook it till it's well done, because that'll just do the whole compliment. So, Dr. Bass, this has been a fantastic conversation. Very lively, lots of laughter, which are the ones that we like the most. Looking ahead before we wrap up, what do you think is the future of beef efficiency and carcass optimization? I know you talked about, you know, the beef herd's going to take some time to rebuild here in the U.S. We're one day closer to rain, but it hasn't come yet. You know, all the factors that you talked about, what's your long range view?
Yeah, well, I'll look into my cloudy crystal ball here.
I don't even have one, so. Yeah.
No, I think we will continue to see a lot of efficiencies at the feed yard level, because that's where we're going to have those really thin margins based on feed availability. We will continue to just try to drive better understanding of livestock nutrition, but then also just ways of managing these animals. There's some really progressive feeders out here in the West. I don't want to call anybody out specifically, but thinking of better ways of managing these animals so that they want to continue to eat even in less than desirable environmental conditions. And so think about, for those who are in the ag business and maybe in the beef business, think about where we finish a lot of these animals. It's often in kind of like high desert climates in many cases, out here in the West especially. You don't want to finish cattle up where we are. We have our tiny little feed yard on the campus at University of Idaho, but it's entirely enclosed or it has a cover over it because we get so much precipitation. It's great to finish these animals out in, say, drier high desert areas. So you got the Snake River Plain in southern Idaho. You got the Columbia Basin in central Washington. Eastern Oregon is great for finishing cattle because it's high desert, drier conditions. That also brings with it a lot of sunlight. And you think about that fat kid that we're trying to make out. And especially if it's got a big black leather jacket on it. That's hard. That's hard on that beef, right? So some of these progressive yards are making enormous efficiency strides by just putting up shade. If we can put up more shade, and the dairy industry is a great example, keeping these cows happy by putting up shade, putting up cover for them, keeping that direct sunlight. Yeah, keeping that direct sunlight off. And the shade at some of these feed yards is something as simple as just like a thick netting that looks like it comes off of a kid's trampoline or something. I mean, it's nothing that substantial, but it's enough to knock down that direct sunlight, and that keeps them that much happier. You know, a lot of these cattle, I mean, I've seen Angus, black-headed cattle, black Limousin, black Simmental raised down in Florida and Louisiana and all over. And honestly, if they're born in that environment, they're usually adapt to it, okay? Mm-hmm. But also think about maybe here up in the Northwest where we've got calves being born out in the sawtooths. So maybe they've never experienced 90-degree weather before, and now they're moved to a feed yard in Boardman or Moses Lake or something like that. And it's just very, very different. Well, if we can make them more comfortable, as much as a great job as our feeders are doing, if we can continue to drive this idea of making these animals as comfortable as possible, they're going to want to eat, they're going to want to grow, and that's good for the bottom line. It's good for the animal as well. How's that?
I think that was a great way to look into your cloudy crystal ball and see where we're going and areas that producers can be looking at to optimize and become more efficient too. So thank you so much for joining us this week. To wrap up the May Beef Month, what's your favorite cut of beef and how do you like it cooked?
Oh, man. That's like asking me my favorite beer. It all depends, right? So our go-to is a ribeye, cooked medium rare. If I can do it over natural wood charcoal, I will. Most of the time, we're on a grill. We got kids. We're on a time budget. Yeah, ribeye, definitely.
Awesome. Well, I would have to agree with that as well. I don't know. A T-bone comes real close to it for me. But thank you again for joining us. And where can listeners find you, Dr. Bass, and where additional resources and so forth that you've been working on?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not very good with social media. I'm sure folks could probably find me if they really wanted to, but I don't keep much up on that side. Really, if you want to get a hold of me, go to the University of Idaho website, uidaho.edu. Search for the Animal Science Department. You'll find me. Beyond that, I do have my literature out there. I wrote a book a couple years ago called It's Not a Cow. You can find that on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It's written exactly how I speak. And so if you had fun listening to this podcast, you'll probably laugh a little bit at the same time. But, you know, it's telling the story of cattle and telling our story that of what we do here. I need to make an updated revision to it already, probably, but it's a short read. It's not a coloring book. It's not a pop-up, but it's an easy read. And the idea of it is to tell a story of animal agriculture, predominantly through cattle, because I'm just so fascinated by cattle, the magic of the rumen and all the amazing things that these animals produce. But in the end, if you are in the agricultural world, I ask that you pass the book on to somebody who's not, so that we can continue to tell the story. So how's that?
Love that.
We'll link it in the show notes. And yeah, we appreciate all the work you're doing and appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to join us this week. And we thank you, listeners, for tuning in as well. Go eat some beef.
Go beef.
Hi, I'm Tom Heron, founder of Ag Professionals. Agriculture is always innovating and evolving. And at Ag Professionals, we provide the expertise to help you stay ahead. From land use planning and environmental compliance, permitting to real estate, civil and environmental engineering, and land surveying, we offer one-stop solutions you need to grow and succeed. We're proud to support the Millennial Ag Podcast because we believe in the future of agriculture. Let's build that future together. Visit our website, agpros.com, to learn how we can help your operation thrive.
Thank you for tuning into this week's episode of the Millennial Ag Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your friends and like, subscribe, and review to our podcast. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, or email us at talktous@millennialag.com. Until next week, we are Millennial Ag.